All right, it's start 8, 954-49.12. You are listening to Star Trek Discovery Pod. My name is Mike. With me is...
Ashley Moreno.
And...
Clyde Haynes.
Guys, Grant's not here. He's definitely not holed up in a hotel room with illegal substances all over the bed while he's gloriously writing some Star Trek fanfic that he's going to sign by Clyde and post on the internet. He's definitely not doing that.
Okay. See, I thought he was just on like the planet Pavo getting high off some spores.
I can tell you that I did have to tell him the name Naked Lunch was already taken and misleading. So
I think it's called Riker Does Riza. That's what he's doing.
I was thinking Rikerd.
Riker. Even
hashtag
better.
Hashtag Rikers. That's the name of it.
All right, so we're talking about episode 8 of Star Trek Discovery. It was a Latin title, so I'm going to butcher it. So enjoy that.
Nice.
Si vis pacem, para bellum, which means if you want peace, prepare for war. So this
ominous.
Week, yeah.
This wish week, I had known that going in. It would have made a whole lot more sense.
This week's episode was penned by Christian Beyer, who's a longtime Star Trek novelist. I haven't read any of her novels, but I heard they're really good.
Yeah, I was listening to reading an article from the EP, and he was answering a question about, you know, what's hard about writing the story. And he mentioned for him, it's the canon, right? Getting those pieces of canon right. And then he turned and said, but for Kristen, who wrote this, that is easy. Like, that's in the can because she's so kind of part of this Star Trek ethos. And I thought you could see that in this show.
You could definitely see that in this episode. It definitely felt like somebody who had been watching Star Trek for the past 40 years wrote this episode. So quick hot takes. Clyde, you're already going. What'd you think about this episode?
You know, I absolutely thought it reminded me of something that was part of the Star Trek universe. And I can't remember the name of the title, but it is, I don't want to call it a trope, but it is this sense of you've got a key character who has mind has been taken over and who just is trying to corrupt the rest of the crew. I feel like it's happened on every series.
Oh, yeah.
I'm reminded of the episode on TNG where they brought back the little game with the visor that was...
With Ashley Judd.
Yes.
Hooking up with Will Wheaton somehow.
Yeah, because that would happen. but I was thinking about that and I was like, yeah. It's like, so it felt part of kind of Star Trek. Like, this was a Star Trek universe. But I thought it was told in a little different way. So I kind of like that. I don't know that I needed the whole Ash and Burnham, like, first kiss, first contact moment.
You're kind of on the fence about this love story happening.
Yeah.
Right?
And I feel like this is a topic that you personally would want to really delve into, that you might have some thoughts on even.
I don't.
Thoughts that you could write down?
in a fictional manner? Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
As a fan?
As a fan. But overall, I was happy with it. I'm finally glad that we were progressing this Federation Klingon War story. So
yeah,
thumbs up. A couple moments there that were a little tricky for me. That's all.
Ash, did you like it?
Yeah, I really liked it. I've liked both of these last two episodes. I feel like they probably have done a lot to get people on board who are sort of like Star Trek Discoveries and Star Trek meh. Because, yeah, I agree with Clyde. Like, this one and last week, I felt like were very Star Trek-y, like, definitely kind of rooted in canon. I'm actually fine with the kind of relationship developing between Burnham and Ash. I mean, obviously, it's not the most interesting part of the show, but that, too, I feel like is a little bit, at least when I think of the series I like best, STNG, like, the kind of interpersonal relationships between them and, like, you know, their home lives and things like that were a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And so I really liked that. I guess in the end, this episode was kind of sad and we got sort of an interesting view of what it would be like to be Saru and how hard that must be. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it gave me, I don't know, new insight into that character, which I really liked.
What this episode did most successfully was show us his perspective. Which is he's always living in fear. I thought that was great. And I really enjoyed all of this episode for several reasons. I mean, Like I said, we got the compelling emotional arc for Saru after he's been kind of a non-presence for the past two episodes. Mm-hmm. So it was great to see him. It was great to see the show just give him this complex story arc. And this set up next week's fall finale really nicely with the Pavins? Is that what they're called?
Yes, yeah. Pavins.
With the Pavins bringing Discovery face to face with a sarcophagus ship at the end. That was pretty cool. And a lot of what was going on during the away mission, to me, kind of seemed to have this interesting, and this is kind of a half-baked idea in my head, but this kind of like meta-textual element to it, where it was possibly commenting on a fundamental aspect of Star Trek itself, which is the idea of Trek depicting this future society where there is no conflict. Did you guys kind of get that? Because I think there was kind of some lampshading going on there, because one of our heroes gets seduced by the idea of living on this beautiful planet, which seems to kind of represent the core ideology that's emblematic of Star Trek, which is the greatness of this aspirational, conflict-free society and world. So I like that this episode explored that, and how the idea of staying on this perfect, peaceful world and leaving the war behind is kind of played as a bad thing. Or like the idea of living in a conflict-free bubble is not something we should necessarily strive for. Did you guys get any of that? It felt like it was commenting on Star Trek itself a little bit.
Yeah, I think what I was looking at was, it's almost like, can you be Switzerland, right? Like, you have this perfect peace, this perfect harmony organization, like the Federation, but it exists and it's always in jeopardy because there's always war. There's always conflict outside. And you play a role. And I think what you saw kind of on this planet was that there was a chief piece of technology that they thought was critical. And then you had to look at, and I love the fact that Burnham started talking about, well, the kind of the directives, right? The core values.
Yeah.
And that became the thing. It's like you've got this planet that says, all right, everything here is about harmony and peace, yet we need to end the war so that we can be like them. And it was just this tension, this constant tension, you know, particularly between Saru, who just wanted to stay in the peace, Burnham, who was trying to advance a new peace, and Ash, who's just like, we need it, even if it violates who we are, because it's worth it.
Yeah, this episode really, like with that trio, we got to learn a lot more about them or recontextualize or reaffirm what we already know about them. Like, Saru is this prey alien who just constantly lives in fear. When he's given the chance to live in this comfortable bubble that allows him to escape that fear, he jumps at it, right? But the contradiction there is that he kind of becomes a bad guy, because he wants to force his friends to stay there too. It's like, no, let's leave the war behind and stay here. I really liked how that played out, how the idea of him not wanting conflict created a conflict. That was pretty cool.
I thought she was going to kill him there for a minute.
I thought so too. And I think it will be an interesting development in their relationship, because obviously Saru blames her for their previous captain's death, mm-hmm. and sees her as a dangerous mutineer. And now, you know, on some level, I think he's walked maybe not a mile, maybe like a couple feet in her shoes. And so I wonder, you know, because he attacked her. That's like kind of what we ended the episode on, was that he attacked her. He could have killed her. He jeopardized their mission. He did a lot of mutineer-ish type things. And so,
oh yeah, it was total mutiny.
Yeah. And so I wonder what that will do for how he views her. And then now that she knows what it's like to be him, you know, there's this rumor that they're kind of thought of as, you know, cowardly kind of creatures. And, you know, if that's the mental state that you're kind of born into, to see what he's accomplished actually shows a lot of heart and a lot of courage. And so, I don't know, it seems like it'll be an interesting development in their relationship.
I too am super excited about this. I mean, this has made me interested in Saru. I know you guys love Saru. But now I
like creatures.
Now I'm like,
wait. You didn't love Saru before?
I thought he was okay.
Oh my God.
I thought he was okay.
All right.
It's okay. He can say that now, you guys. Yeah. He's on board.
But now, what I'm looking at is they've had this almost adversarial dynamic.
Yeah.
And I think we have the benefit of seeing Burnham from a different perspective. We were there. We were there on the Klingon ship, and so we don't hate Burnham from the very beginning.
No, we do not.
Right, but Saru, and so I've kind of been like, dude, you've got to get over this, right? And he hasn't. But now that he's, as you put it, Ashley, he's walked in her shoes a bit, I see them moving away and moving towards this like brother sister dynamic. Like they've it's like the brother and sister who don't get along because they want the love of the parent more than the other. And now you're looking at two people who I think we're going to see more and more collaborate together. And this is the unfolding of Burnham's kind of inner circle. You know, she's got Tilly and Ash, and now I think Saru, who's going to understand, wow, like I was so hateful of you because I thought this was impossible, and here I was about to kill you. So maybe I need to lighten up a little bit. That's what I'm hoping for, and it's got me excited to see what the dynamic is, because for me, it really is about this crew coming together and being, you know, I hate to say it, but I want the Enterprise. I want everybody like working together.
Yeah, and we're getting there. It seems like with every episode, the problems the haters have are going away, or they're not going away, but it's like the episodes are kind of saying quiet down. It's given more fuel to the people who like this show and the people who say, no, this is actual Star Trek. This is still Star Trek, even though it's darker, even though there's more conflict, even though it's during wartime. There's still some basic tenets of Star Trek here where there's characters working together for a greater good.
I got a question for you, Mike, because I know you're a big fan of DS9.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, on DS9, did you have those stories that were, like, you might have an episode that was really about, like, a B-plot character development between two people? We haven't really gotten that with this one, right? Like, we get some interesting things, but it's not like, hey, we're going to have a whole episode where we just explore Saru's life back on his home world, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like this, like
we're like just a side story,
a huge side story that takes up the entire episode.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have a whole lot of conflict. It's just character building. We haven't seen that.
Well, you're going to write that.
Maybe I will.
Who does Saru bone when he goes home?
Right. Applied. But think about it, though. Like, did they have that on DS9, especially toward the end when it was more about war with the Dominion?
They still did. Yeah, okay. They still made room for that kind of stuff. But what they did in DS9, which was great, and it's almost what they do here, every time they had a side story that was about a character's home life or, you know, a marriage situation or something like that, it was always a metaphor for something, for some kind of social commentary. Like, there's this one episode where there's a Ferengi bar, right? Mm-hmm. And sorry, this is a sidestep. But yeah, there's a Ferengi bar, and the Ferengi, it's basically a battle between a brother who owns the bar and a brother who is a waiter at the bar.
Yeah, Quark and
Rom. Yeah. Yep. And it basically becomes a treatise on anti-capitalism, you know? And it's great. It's played out that way. It's really an emotional story, but it's really all about, you know, breaking down capitalism and displaying the problems with it. So that's interesting.
So do you want more of that on this show?
I think eventually, maybe not now.
Do you think the haters want more of that?
I think so. Yeah? Because I think that's Trek canon, right? Mm. That kind of allegory, mm-hmm. I think is really, really central to Star Trek. But right now, I mean, I guess we're going to get 9 episodes out of this season. I don't know these characters.
Well, we got one more before the break, and then what? 8 more, something like that?
Yeah, 1 more, and then it comes back in January.
Comes back in January.
8 more, yeah. But I love what you guys were saying about, because I didn't think about this a lot, the evolution of Saru and him being put in Michael Burnham's shoes. I do remember we see him towards the end of this whole crazy mission, and he wakes up in the hospital bed. He's very ashamed.
Yeah.
He's really ashamed of what he's done. But it didn't really dawn on me that he was literally, like, not literally, but really put into her shoes. And what is this going to mean for them going forward? Like, their relationship just keeps developing and changing. And I love that this series does that so well. While, like, it did all that character work while giving us a fun suspenseful away mission.
Yeah, I was super excited to have an away mission.
Yeah, it was cool.
Those are super fun.
It was about time. It really was about time.
I was a little sad it wasn't that rocky, smoky planet that looks like a Trapper Keeper that was used for every away mission in STNG, but that's okay. That's on me. I have my own expectations.
The name of the planet was Pavo?
Pavo?
Pavo.
Okay, I was calling it Planet Eastern Canada.
Well, I think that's where they shot it.
Right.
But yeah.
One other kind of development sort of side story that I really liked was the conversation between Tilly and Stamets.
I knew you were going to say that.
I was waiting for somebody to get there.
I'm trying really hard not to say Tilly's name because Mike likes to tease me about that. So thanks, Ashley, for bringing it up.
You're welcome. Tilly sitting.
Aw, she's cute.
No, I'm just kidding. I think she's an interesting plot piece in terms of how she drives some of the more social elements. If you think about it, there's no one else who drives the hey, let's talk. Like,
hey, let's be friends,
guys. And it's so wonderfully ironic because I think the idea is that she's like the quirky weird one who doesn't understand social norms. And so that she's the one who's able to bring people kind of to new sort of emotional places is really charming, I think.
Yeah, everybody else is super focused. Like, they're so focused about everything. But Tilly's like, no, let's talk. Now.
So yeah, I loved Stamets's comment because this whole idea of like, you know, oh, I'm burning my candle at both ends because I work so hard, I care so much, will only take a character so far. So his explanation on not wanting to go to medical, not wanting to figure out the effects of what the spore drive does, that it obviously he wants to continue using this technology and Starfleet might have some issues if it's hurting people is one thing. But in his case, his partner's literally the doctor who will be in the awkward position to either send him away and thus be hurt or send him away because he has to go get medical attention or sit on it, which would be horrible for his career. And either way, this person that he loves is going to be hurt.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, oh God, that is such a, it's all your science. It's all your research. It's all your hard work. And the person you love is now in danger. And that's a lot of pressure.
And that development is a great example of how this show is really about people.
Yeah.
It's about the characters. Like we get at the beginning, the first thing we see is this epic space battle where Lorca is just in his element, you know, and he's like, let's take these ships down. And he's enjoying himself, you know, and he's like, go.
Yeah, when Discovery takes the shot for the other ship, that was so great.
Yes.
I loved that moment.
That was fantastic.
It was nicely done, too.
Yeah. It was fun to watch. It was super fun.
We get that and we get all the pew, 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 you know, and that's awesome. But really, what I was worried about when we first started covering this show, we saw the bridge crew of the Shenzhou, and we didn't get to know them.
Not a person.
So it was like, these are just empty vessels around these characters. And we only hung out with Michael Burnham. And I was worried that this wasn't going to be a character show. It was going to be mainly a plot-driven show. And the plot is there, and it's good. But as it's gone on, it's very much about these characters. Because the plot allows us some really great character growth and character conflict, like you were talking about with Stamets and the Doctor. It's not just like, oh, you know, the spore drive is messing with my perception and emotions and causing me to
behave rashly or something.
Yeah.
Because it is doing that.
Right.
But also,
the bigger problem is if I tell the doctor, well, he's my boo, and it might be a really complicated issue for him. And that's like the real issue.
I will say, though, there are three people on the bridge whose names I don't even really know.
That's true.
And I need to know more, right? We know
at least
Kayla.
We heard their names
Kayla.
Today.
We know Kayla, and I don't even know the anthropomorph android that sat in the chair, like, was basically
new Daft Punk backup drive.
You know, she actually took the con while Lorca went off. Like, all this is, I'm like, well, I'd like to know who they are. Otherwise, I'm just gonna have to start calling them random bridge senior officer.
But I
agree with you, Mike.
Well, it is interesting that this show is not about the bridge crew if you don't count Lorca. It's not really about them. They're kind of ancillary players. It's more about everybody in engineering. Which makes it more about the science crew than the battle crew, which is interesting.
In the middle of a war.
Do you guys like Lorca's catchphrase? Go. Because I can't see him saying make it so or engage. I think go is nice and succinct. I think it works.
I didn't even really notice it, but now that you say it.
He said it a couple times.
The thing I don't like about it is that it's it's, well, it fits Lorca because it's arrogant, right? It's kind of like, hurry up already. Like, go.
He might as well.
What are you, he might as well said, what are you waiting on?
He might as well just be like, do it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's one thing that's interesting to me about this show that I'm struggling with just a little bit is that we know the future, right? And so I'm looking at Stamets and going, like, I don't know if anybody else knows, but we, the viewer, know this is bad. And the reason why we know it's bad is this spore drive technology does not make it.
There's no nipple juicing beyond this.
Right. Like, yeah. This is it. Like, so we know that. We know that the as much as they're trying to look for a solution to being able to detect Klingons that are cloaked, we know that never happens.
That's true.
Like, it never,
that's true.
You're not going to find it because that never happens.
Yeah.
I mean, Data's going to create a tachyon field that will kind of let you know if they pass through it. But for the most part, yeah, you're not going to find that. Like, we do know that the war ends. Like, there are things that we know. And so sometimes it's hard to watch this crew pursue something that you just know is a failure.
I don't know. That doesn't bother me. Does that bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me. I also worry for Stamets, though, because the kind of sacrificial pose he kind of takes on to, like,
true.
Do that. And Jesus, we know the fork drive is there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, he does, like, have the arms out, like, yeah, that's.
I know. I'm like, oh God, there's no way you're gonna make it through this.
That's a very good pickup, Ashley. I'm sure they did that on purpose.
Well, of course they did.
Yeah. So I'm worried about him because I like his character, obviously.
I love
so.
The character, and of course, we all love Anthony Rapp's intern, who listens to our podcast and tweets for Anthony Rapp about our podcast.
Yes,
and we love Anthony Rapp and support him.
We do, absolutely,
especially during what he's going through right now.
Yeah, so brave though. Yeah. So brave.
So we finally went back on the Klingon ship. I know we've kind of been back and forth about these Klingon scenes. Sometimes they're really compelling. Sometimes they're just people in obtrusive masks who are doing half-ass Shakespeare. Did you like going back to the Klingon ship this time? What'd you think about this arc?
I did. I really did like that quite a bit. It's making me more and more nervous about who Ash really is because he's too sexy to be a guy in disguise. I will not accept it.
Yeah.
I really did like going back in Laurel, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So seeing that kind of the development with Laurel, curious what will happen to her. And it is making it possible. Like, I don't know totally what to think of her character and maybe what Vok and that sect might be doing, but the bringing in this idea that the people who have taken over have no honor and that we might live in a world better for Klingons and in a world where honor exists, if actually, like, maybe they were wrong about Starfleet.
Yeah.
So kind of introducing that idea takes this conflict in an interesting way. Not that I totally trust her, but if that is where we're going, I think that from a plot perspective or from a story writing perspective, it introduces a whole Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy like aspect of storytelling that can happen if the writer so chose. And so as opposed to kind of writing yourself into a corner, it seems like they kind of opened up opportunities without Twin Peaksing it, without making it so crazy we've lost track of what it is we're doing.
And it's doing all that, and it tracks, right? It tracks for Star Trek, because the Klingons we know in the TNG era and beyond are all about honor, right?
Yeah.
They're all about that stuff. And we're seeing a leader here who is not about that at all. You know, he took advantage of T'Kuvma trying to unite all the houses. And it's just a power grab for this guy. And Laurel sees it, and she sees it as Cole, or is it Core?
Cole House of Core,
right. She sees it as Cole just tainting what T'Kuvma was trying to do for his own power grab. So, yeah, she's against it. And if more Klingons like her prevail, then that's going to lead us to the Klingons we know and love, which are more honorable type people who are more willing to work alongside the Federation.
Were you surprised that she wanted to defect? And do you believe that she wanted to
defect?
I
don't know what to believe. I know, you know, her and Cornhole. Yeah.
I believe it's Cornhole.
It's Cornhole, yeah. Madam Cornhole.
Obviously.
Admiral Cornhole.
Admiral Cornholio, yes.
Don't disrespect her. It's Admiral.
Admiral Cornholio. She needs teepee for her bunhole. Yeah.
Topical. topical reference that, right? there.
Yeah,
it's kids, kids love
only
that.
About 20 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
Come on, we're talking Star Trek. Got old people listening.
So old now.
I'm not going to do the impression. But yeah, I like that we got to... We actually revisited Cornwall, or whatever her name is, after a whole episode of not even... No one bringing up what was going on with her. And I found those scenes between her and Laurel really effective, mm-hmm. even though I was guessing as to what Laurel's motives were throughout the whole thing. I like their interplay a lot. And I like the game they were playing to try and trick the other Klingons.
Here's what was really fascinating to me is that we're brought in to Laurel, and we've seen Laurel a number of times at this point. I think we've seen Laurel probably more than any other Klingon since Vok has been like MIA since episode 3.
Wonder why.
So, but we are used to Laurel, and we see that Laurel has, she's always been kind of sharp, right? Like she moves one way only to show up somewhere else, right? Like the whole getting Vok off the ship and kind of giving him another ship. Like she seems to be pretty crafty. And so it's interesting to see her here and interacting with Cornwell. And then I'm thinking, wow, they're going to, like, this is going to happen. They're going to get off the ship and let's see. Like, I'm so focused on trying to figure out if she's being honest to Admiral Cornwell that I'm starting to notice, like, maybe I've underestimated Cole a little bit. Because every time we turn around, he's crushing everybody,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, he's a step ahead. And so when we look up and I'm looking, I was first focused on this dynamic between Laurel and Cornwell. And then I had to turn around and go, well, no, I'm actually really interested in this dynamic between Laurel and Cole.
She hates him.
He did to her almost the exact same thing he did to Vok, right? Like, hey, you know what? Like, I know you don't like me and I don't like you either, but I need you. So if you'll confess your loyalty to me, I'll keep you around. And she goes, okay. And then he goes, did you think I was stupid?
Mm-hmm.
And then just takes her off. Like, I think we might need to give him a little bit more credit than we have before.
I hate him.
I hate him. But as a villain, I mean, he might be...
Yeah.
He might be pretty decent.
He's just like, you don't play a player, girl. What's
right.
that? Yeah.
One thing I thought was kind of cool about the Klingon exchanges in this is that if this episode really is about kind of learning... getting insight into the characters and this whole idea of kind of seeing something from someone else's perspective. I liked the conversation between the Admiral and Laurel. She's like, you know, you've kind of surprised me. And she was like, oh, you surprised me too. And I think it's going to take these interactions with humans and members of Starfleet and seeing Klingons who are honorable and who are not for what initially got all of this started to be turned into something new. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I start thinking back to that first episode we saw where they were, like, talking about purity and all this kind of fucked up shit, mm-hmm. right? That was very, you know, just straight up kind of racist yeah. sort of commentary. And so I thought that we were starting to see where somebody who potentially had such horrible sort of opinions about people that they probably had never even met start to change too. So I kind of liked seeing that change that we were seeing in other races and the humans and aliens that are on Starfleet also happening with some of the Klingons we're getting to know better, to where there could be some complications in their positions. It would be nice.
I think you bring up a great point when you talk about kind of where Laurel started out and thinking like, wow, we need to wipe out everybody and just be pure.
Yeah.
To then looking and having this conversation with Cornwell and going, how do you treat your prisoners, right? Which is a huge philosophical question.
Yeah.
And she's explaining, and I was a little amused that she says, though we're humane. And I'm like, you just used the word human to an alien. Like, what? They don't even know what the hell that means. But so she's basically saying, you know, we hold them, we keep them, and then after the war, we release them. And then you juxtapose that to Cole, who we see Laurel walk into her ship, and every one of her comrades has been brutally killed.
Yeah.
And I think she's looking and going, you know, these are my own people. My own people are treating us far more savagely than the enemy. And I think it's those moments that really open up And I'm excited to see what, I'm at least hopeful, what that might mean for the prospect of peace. But this is a TV show that's based about a war.
So I don't where the know Klingons are the bad guys.
They are, but I'm just saying, I don't think we're getting close to peace anytime soon.
Yeah, but it is cool to see those sort of windows. And, you know, just when every day you sit down and it's like more bad news and more bad news in real life, to sort of, it's kind of, while it's darker than I'm used to when I sit down to watch Trek, it's also oddly hopeful, you know?
It is, because even in a dark moment like that, where we see Laurel walk into this part of the ship where all her dead comrades are laying around, and she's like, some of these trees were my friends. Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what it reminded me of.
Topical.
Right. But hey, I got all the hot references, man. I'm spitting hot fire over here.
There's going to be 15-year-old boys listening to our podcast every day from now on.
Every day.
Just got our thumb on the pulse of the youth.
What's up, millennials? So yeah, when she, even though it's such a dark, somewhat disturbing scene, I mean, you see these bodies all mangled and gross. It also signifies a change in her perspective, where she's like, okay, maybe supporting this crazy dictator who kills everybody who doesn't agree with him is not the best way to a bright future for my people. So maybe we need a change here.
Well, yeah, and like, it's sort of interesting to think about her role in as like a catalyst for all that has happened, because that sort of racist kind of ideology was really what was driving that crew initially. And to know that all of this has happened as kind of fallout from the war that they started, and then to find out that of course that isn't the way that you should be viewing other living things, must be, I don't know. I mean, that's a heavy burden. I'm not saying she doesn't deserve it. I'm just saying that's a heavy burden.
It is a heavy burden. And it goes back to the idea, which I just can't get stuck. I just can't get unstuck from my head, of the metaphor that was this planet on the away mission, where all the living things on the planet work together harmoniously. They've learned to understand each other. All the, you know, the trees, the animals, whatever, has learned to understand each other and become this unified sentient being that can communicate to other species as a planet, you know? So what we're seeing there again is a physical representation of the ideals of the Federation and Star Trek. You know, it's just coming together in a peaceful way.
But I also agree with you, Mike, in the fact that just like the Federation also typically will insert itself in the middle of conflict.
Yeah.
And frequently yes. believe that just by bringing the two parties together and right. kind of talking it out, that they'll promote peace. And in, you know, in a series like the Next Generation, you saw that all the time, right?
Yeah.
Like, they land on a planet, and, you know, the prime director...
Guys, come to the conference room.
We'll bring you in, and we're going to talk, and we'll be here for a while, and then, you know, it's going to negotiate peace. But I'm fairly certain in saying that as these, you know, as the Klingons and the Federation show up at this planet, you know, Paru, or Pavo...
Pavo.
Then...
Pablo Picasso.
That's not going to happen here.
You know, that was...
Doesn't look that way now.
No.
Doesn't
bring
look that
way. Conference room with some that was, spore magic, and no, it's not happening.
That was a cool twist for me. And maybe it wasn't even a twist. Maybe I'm dumb. Because I saw that the Klingons picked up Pavu, whatever.
Pavu.
Yeah, on their screen or whatever. And like, okay, let's go there. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, okay, what Burnham and Saru feared is coming true. The Klingons learned about this planet, learned that there's technology that could cause their cloaks to be nil, and they're going to go destroy this place.
Yeah, that planet's toast.
Yeah, I felt so bad, right? I was like, oh, this sucks, and this is a sad reversal to what's going on here. But the twist was that it was the actual planet that brought the Klingons there. I was like, whoa, this is nuts, you know?
Planet.
Yeah.
Billy planet.
Yeah. So, yeah, who's going to lose there? It's probably going to be the planet.
Absolutely. I mean, they lured the Admiral and their team, and which was supposed to be Sarek, into this let's talk about peace, and then literally slit their throats right after they beamed in.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that the possibility, because we're talking about Cole here, right?
Yeah.
If we were talking about Vok, or we were talking about Laurel or someone else.
With Vok, if it was Vok commanding that ship, you can just like, you know, wave something shiny in the other direction. And he'd be like, oh, I'll go over like, there.
Ooh, squirrel.
Yeah.
But because we're talking about Cole, who likes to kill first and ask questions later, I don't even, he's going to cloak in to this place and we're going to be in a battle almost immediately. I'm not hopeful that it's going to be a good negotiation.
No, I don't see a lot of positive outcomes on this one.
But I do wonder if this is where the Federation starts to think that they could do that. Maybe this is where they get some of that inspiration to let's negotiate and broker peace between two people, two people groups.
Because you do have a mix of perspectives even on the Discovery. You have Michael Burnham, who does want to end the war, but would probably most likely want to do it in a peaceful way. And then you have somebody like Tyler, who we like and enjoy as a character, and maybe even as a love interest for Michael Burnham.
And Ashley.
And Ashley.
I'm sorry?
And Ashley.
A love interest for Ashley.
And Ashley. Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah.
I mean,
and
whichever.
All of us. For all of us, really. He's a good-looking man. So where was I going with this? You got me thinking about this guy now.
That's the problem. Those dreamy eyes.
Yeah.
My
eyes have turned into cartoons.
You were talking about the differences between the perspectives of someone like Burnham who wants to end the war.
Yeah, and Ash is just like, I want to hurt these guys. You know? I want to hurt them. And that is so like non-Starfleet of the, you know.
It's kind of Klingon-y.
It's very Klingon-y.
It's kind of Klingon.
Yeah.
It's kind of
like
clingy.
It's kind of like if you left somebody on the ship of the, on an old broken down Shenzhou and hope that they die, they'd kind of be upset and want to kill you. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just me. Thoughts.
Just you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just you and a million others watching this show.
Yeah. It does make me appreciate how quickly Lorca takes to Ash, because of course he does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like we talk about Ash and some of his more Klingon-y ways, and you're like, and that's why Lorca loves you.
It's like, you want to blow shit up too? My boy.
Yeah. Have you ever considered being head of security?
Yeah.
As teenagers, those two got in a lot of trouble.
It's true.
Hey, you want to come to my room and kind of dissect this trouble for fun? Yeah, let's do it. But yeah, the conflict next week, where this episode leaves us and what it sets up is great, because it's not just two adversarial ships facing each other and we're going to see a showdown, but it's how the crews on each of those ships have different ideas of how to fight or deal with the adversary. So there's going to be all kinds of conflict on the Discovery, all kinds of conflict on the sarcophagus ship, and of course the major conflict in between those two. And then, you know, some terror going down on this planet full of peace and love. A lot of heavy shit coming down.
Yeah. I got a question for you guys, though.
Yeah.
Admiral Cornwell. She's still alive, right?
Oh,
I think so.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I'm gonna go yes on that.
I mean, she's going to wake up, be surrounded by a bunch of dead bodies and not know what the hell's going on. Might get freaked out a little bit, but I absolutely think she's alive.
Yeah, she's totally alive.
And I think carrying back stories that, hey, what we thought, that maybe not all Klingons are on board with this whack job.
Hashtag not all Klingons.
Yeah, exactly.
Hashtag Lorca's going to freak out.
Yeah, he's going to be like,
oh, okay, I guess I have to kill you myself now.
Like, did you see her when Laurel was like, and let's go to your ship? And she was like, my ship? What are you talking about? I don't have a ship.
Mm-hmm. And she was like, yeah, you do.
And discovered, she was like, oh.
Right.
Yeah, with that psychopath. Right, okay.
So I actually had a question. Like, speaking of kind of, I left this episode with more questions, which is always fun. I think it's a sign of good writing. I'm not confused. I just have a lot more questions than I think going into it. And one of the other kind of loose ends that's sort of floating out there that I'm just sort of in the back of my mind whenever I'm watching it, waiting for it to come back up, is I want to say in episode 6 that ends with Stamets brushing his teeth and then he's about to go to bed and he walks away from the mirror and then there's that other image of him in the mirror. So there's still weird bizarro shadow land going on behind all of this. And I'm not sure if I wasn't picking up on any subtleties, but I don't think I've seen that since. No. And I was going to ask you guys.
We haven't. Like when we first see Stamets in this episode, it reminded me of that because I thought, well, where's the payoff there? And he disconnects his nipples from the spore drive. Okay, it's his arms. I'll cop to that. And he sees Tilly and he's like, oh, Lorca, Captain, what are you doing here? So his perspective is off. And I was thinking, okay, is he just weakened and tired that he's not perceiving things properly? Or is, you know, because we have lots of theories about what happened to him with the mirror that time. Mm-hmm. Like maybe it was a future version of himself or a past version. So it was.
And he's
like,
definitely fourth dimensional ish now.
Yeah.
We know that from last week.
Yeah. So it was like, well, maybe he's it's not just that he's tired and drained in this moment and that's why his perception's cloudy, but maybe he's seeing the future.
You know, I thought, so when he said, hey, Captain, what are you doing here? He didn't say Lorca. He just said Captain. And so there was a moment there was like, is he seeing the future? Does Tilly actually become Captain?
And that's her goal.
That's her goal. Yeah. I'm like, they did give, like, why would they give us that early on? So maybe somehow Tilly does become Captain.
Mm-hmm. I would love that.
Yeah.
That would be a fabulous, like, long-term.
I mean, she's got to kill a lot of people to get there. Like, she's got to go to Tyler and Saru.
She's got to kill a lot of people to get there.
Like, it's the, you know, the order, the pecking order. She's at the bottom.
But she's going to throw the best parties, though, when she's captain.
She does.
There are other ships, and if not, it's a tough time.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, things happen to 10, I guess, crew members before it probably falls to Tilly.
Yeah.
Or she gets a new ship, and no one actually has to die.
Okay, one cool thing that was revealed in this episode, Saru is a fucking track star.
Yeah, that was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I liked learning more about his abilities.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to see him not only run. I mean, watching that visually was really interesting, but the fight scene between him and Burnham was kind of cool too.
That was cool. Props to Doug Jones, not only doing some amazing physical acting that he's known for, but we see a lot more of it here because he's off the ship and he's on a planet and he's running and kicking and doing all these cool tricks. But when he was being so aggressive, which is not what we've seen of Saru in the past, that shit was a little unnerving. Like, he did a great job. Hats off to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I totally bought it. And that shift from him being such a kind of submissive and passive character to being so aggressive, not easy to pull off, especially in so many prosthetics. But yeah, I totally bought it. It was scary. Also, cool running effect.
Yes, yeah. Very cool. So you mentioned this earlier, but did you think it was awkwardly inserted or did you appreciate the scene with Burnham and Ash where they literally quote Star Trek II, the needs for the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one? I mean, to me, it seemed a little shoehorned in, but if you take the context of their conversation, it did seem organic.
Who gets their first kiss in the middle of a first contact with an alien species?
People on the Star Trek apparently. TV
now,
show.
Look,
yeah.
She's been
Don't
in prison,
judge.
So
judge.
I mean, she could just a little tough. I can understand. But I thought it was a little bit awkward. I liked it better on the Groundhog Day episode where they were kind of going back. Like that seemed,
me too.
That seemed more natural to me. This one seemed a little bit like I was searching for the purpose. Mm. Right? Like I was searching for the purpose. And I don't know that I ever really came up with this is why this is important to the storyline. This is why this is important to that moment. Like it's clear that they were trusting each other and starting to having this conversation about what they wanted. And it brought us back to this reality, like the conversation did, that right now, if the war were to end, Burnham might go back to jail. Like she's not scot-free. Like it's easy to look at her as this pivotal piece of the crew and who's on her way to stardom again, but actually she's still kind of a convict. But I don't know, I needed the kiss and this, you know, starry-eyed conversation to get me there. So I'm still searching to see if there's something.
If it gets me closer to a sex scene between both of them, I'm fine with it.
And there we are. No, I guess for me, I was okay with it. First, I really saw it as a grounding, so sort of the latter part of what you were just saying, as far as like, hey guys, remember, she fucked up big time. Not the kind of fuck up that we can just, you know, sweep hand under the rug.
Yeah,
for sure. And then I also, I guess I chalked it up to, well, they know, even if they don't have a clear memory, that there were some sort of relations between them on another day, and they know from Stamets that they were both pretty into it. I don't know if you can go to weird twinkly planet and not smooch that dude. Or that lady, whatever.
It was such a beautiful setting.
It really was.
The mood was set.
Yeah, you already know you've smooched.
Yeah.
So, and it's very starry. Yeah. So.
The mood was set.
I think the thing that worries me or allows me to be a little bit hesitant, I feel like I'm a little protective of Burnham as kind of the star and clearly like my favorite character on the show. Is that she is completely inexperienced in this area, right? Like, she's talked about, like, she's never been to a party. She couldn't dance. Like, it's safe to say she's never had a date before.
Probably not.
And Ash is like Mr. Smooth, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
He's just so smooth. Like, he's in a room and Tilly's looking at him and rando girl over here, Kayla's looking at, like, everybody's looking at Ash, and he gets up and speeches and does a speech, and everyone's like, oh, you can hear the swoon. And so when he's kind of laying this game on Burnham, I'm like, man, that makes me trust you less. I was starting to trust you more, and now I don't trust you.
Yeah.
Accurate.
Yeah.
I do think it's funny to contrast that with, like, I'm not saying that Riker isn't a very handsome man, but it was always kind of funny when it's like Riker was always getting all these ladies everywhere they go, or like Kirk is always getting all these ladies everywhere they go. See, and I'm trying to decide if their handsomeness is just, I don't know, maybe just like a little bit like dated or what. But when this dude walks in the room and everybody like looks over, it's just like, okay, I could buy that.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't think it's dated. I think the thing that made Riker and Kirk interesting from that standpoint is that she couldn't figure out why. Right?
Like, she was like, oh my God, why am I going home with Riker? Like, I mean, he steps over
it's
a chair.
It's not a shot at Jonathan Frakes.
Absolutely
right?
not.
Not a shot. Talented guy, actor, director.
Fine looking man.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Very attractive.
Sure.
But the way his character
Very
was
tall.
Written, it wasn't like Riker was like really, really smooth. It's not like he'd lean in and be like, hey, so you know, it's not just the many, but the few matters. Like, Riker wasn't doing things like that.
No, he was.
Ash walks into a room and everybody's like,
just so, panties.
Yeah.
They just throw panties at his head. Yeah.
So with Riker, you'd be like, oh yeah, whatever, it's written that way, so I'll go with it. But this guy, you're like, no, I believe it, and it's making me a little nervous.
Yeah, even so, like, I still, the interesting thing is, we don't know whether or not he's genuine in his affection or apparent affection for Burnham. He's talking about, like, he says things like, well, if you're going to go back to jail after the war, maybe we need to keep this war going so I can spend more time with you.
Yeah, that's game.
Yeah. Like, that game?
That's stupid.
Okay.
Like, to say it, like, who?
That's not true love?
Why would you, like, who would believe it? You know what? I'll let the war go on just so I could be with you a little longer. That's game.
Yeah, a little
that
over the top.
Game.
A little heavy. Yeah. I might let it slide on the surface of Pavo, but otherwise, a little heavy.
Like, if you sat down and really think about it, you'd be like, that's dumb. Why? Like, you're crazy, stalker.
Yeah, put that down on one of my more interesting decisions back in college.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I get it.
I will say the details of his story, that's what I mean. Like, I was going, well, maybe this guy isn't a Klingon. Maybe he's not Vok, because the details which he talks about things they're so believable.
And he's very human.
He is. And so then, but then to get all smooth, I'm like, I don't know that, like, I'm actually kind of moving away from thinking he is a Klingon, but there's something about him that I have not put my finger on.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's something off. I'm not sure what it is. I don't know if it's that he's a Klingon. I don't know if I just get lost in his dreamy, dreamy eyes and then I leave confused. But there's something strange There's something strange about him, for sure.
Not to mention
and
that...
And Admiral brought that up.
Yes.
She was just like, how do you even know this person?
Mm-hmm. And not to mention that in this episode, he has to be briefed on, like, what first contact policy is and what, you know, the...
That's a good
all
point.
That stuff. Yeah. And part of that can just be like, okay, audience, here's what all that means.
Or that he just was choosing to ignore it. And she's like, you know, we have to now follow first contact protocol.
Yeah, but it really seemed like she was... schooling him on some basic Starfleet shit.
Yeah, I still feel like we don't really know his service record.
He could just be an enlisted man who didn't go to the academy.
Yeah. I know that Lorca, during shooting kind of that target practice scene where, you know, CBS...
In the non-holodeck?
Yeah, and when CBS All Access was twitching out for everybody and we were like, what's going on? But during that scene, Lorca's talking to him a little bit about his background, but I didn't get a sense of understanding really his service record, meaning, you know, what was his grade before he became chief of security? Like, that's a pretty significant jump. Like, was he an ensign? Was he even a security officer? Mm-hmm. Where did he serve? Like, we get nothing. And so, when you look up and ask, how does he not know, you know, first contact? Like, it's kind of puzzling. Like, who is this guy?
Yeah, it's just...
Who cares?
Got a crush on him like everyone else, it seems like.
Yeah. All right, we have a little bit of time for some listener questions, so let's jump to that.
Hufnagel.
I think we might have one from Hufnagel. If we have time, we'll do Hufnagel. Okay, so listener, you can visit us at StarTrekPod.com. Click on that Facebook link. Click on that Twitter link. Engage with us there. Ask us questions about the podcast, about the episode. We will answer them on the pod. If we don't get to your questions on the pod, we'll definitely reach out to you on social media. You can also visit us at Patreon.com/StarTrekPod. Give us a buck or two an episode. You can listen to some bonus podcasts we have on there on Patreon. And we also have a new reward tier that is kind of taking off, guys. We have our private Slack channel where it's all of us talking to anybody who supports us at the $2 an episode level on Patreon. So we already have a bunch of fun conversations going on there about the show, theories about Discovery on our private Slack channel with a couple of listeners, and we're having a good time talking to them every day.
We even talk about ideas for fan fiction.
We do.
Starring Riker as a chef. Yeah.
it has to happen.
An urban metal jazz band. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, He plays the trombone.
Fantastic. So yeah, visit us at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. And if you're a $2 supporter, you get to hang out with us all day on Slack. So let's jump to these listener questions. Actually, we have two corrections/clarifications about last week's episode, but they're very nice.
Love it.
Nope. Very nice. Usually Star Trek fans are like, you got this wrong, but these guys were cool. So Joe Byram, I believe on Twitter, we were talking about Harry Mudd's spacesuit in the last episode, and Grant likened it to like a Donnie Darko bunny suit. Joe Byram actually tells us that was an Andorian spacesuit.
Oh.
The Andorian.
Shut up, Joe.
No. No, okay. Thank you, Joe.
Because we had no idea.
No, so I didn't know.
I should have known.
Appreciate that.
The Andorians are the blue guys with the antenna. Yeah, they were on the original series.
So the bunny ears would be for their antennas.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Good catch, Joe.
Thank you. Keep coming. Thank you for that clarification.
And Daniel Hood, a loyal listener, says, I'm sure that I'm not the only one with this correction, but Harry Mudd was not in the Trouble with Tribbles episode. We said he was. The Mudd-S character is named Cyrano Jones, played by Stanley Adams, just letting you know. So let's see. We have, our friend Darcy on Twitter, who's also a member of Lorca's Menagerie on Slack, which is what we call our private Slack channel. Well, I did make a few jokes about the spore drive milking.
You did.
Anthony Rapp's nipples in order to engage.
Which, in light of the information that came out after the podcast,
oh, you got to mention
a little bit rough.
You got to mention that. You got to mention that. Darcy says, "Who do I talk to about having all mentions of nipple juice removed from my brain?" Thanks.
I'll take this one.
You'll take it?
I'm going to do my best to clear up some misunderstandings that it sounds like happened in my absence. My apologies.
That we won't let that happen when you leave us to our
I
own
devices. I left you guys alone for one night. What happened?
Went a little wild.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Well,
all right, let's get to
Darcy, I'm on it.
Yeah. Let's get to Jonathan Huffnagel's question. Okay, Huffnagel says, or does someone else want to read Huffnagel's comment? Yay. Have fun with that.
Okay, so this week I get the honor.
I don't have to see it to know. Go ahead.
Yeah, what if I told you, Clyde, that it was only about four lines long?
I would feel ashamed and corrected.
Actually, the correct response was you would not believe me, because the comment coming from Jonathan Huffnagel is, of course, a couple paragraphs.
Let's hear it. Let's hear
okay. Groundhog Day episodes almost feel like a rite of passage for a sci-fi show, and Star Trek has a few to choose from. Hell, they made an entire movie based around a similar concept. We all have nostalgic childhood memories we want to live in and lost loved ones we want to regain time with. We've also all made mistakes we wish we could undo, but the risk of erasing our friendships and we also all have mistakes we wish we could undo, but risk erasing our friendships entirely. The fun of this trope is that it's not about challenging or reliving the past. It is about making the most out of whatever random present day is frozen. Carpe diem, forced upon you. Certain activities may quickly turn futile, such as trying to hone art and writing skills when none of your production is saved. I am sure we all have a bookstore we would read for free and without the need of shelf space at home. We all could desire to eat without consequence or cost and try all the new things on all the new menus. Seeing how we are all TV and movie nerds, no doubt we would empty our local rental store to watch endless varieties of movies with as many different friends as possible. After we get that out of our systems, what would you guys choose to do next? I would play endless board games with different varieties of friends each day. The random chance of probability should keep everything fresh.
Okay, so what will we do in a Groundhog Day situation?
Yeah, I think that's the question. So you're free of consequence.
Is that the question?
Yeah.
It is novel that he wrote here?
Yep, allow me. I speak Huffnagel. The question is, we all love the movie Groundhog Day. We all love Bill Murray. We all love the trope. Given a world where there really is no consequence, how would you guys pass your time?
I would not want to indulge my worst instincts. But I would totally indulge my worst instincts, at least for the first few years. I was going to say months, but I got to be honest with myself. And let's see, what would be those worst instincts? They might have something to do with taking revenge on a certain spineless governor that we have. That somebody was talking about earlier. I'm not naming names. Moving on, Clyde.
Well, I mean, I definitely would try a ton of different food. I'd probably want to learn how to play the guitar.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, and maybe a different language, like guitar and maybe French.
You wouldn't beat up a politician in a wheelchair?
No. You're a better man than I. I wouldn't do that. But I think one of the things I loved about Groundhog Day was there was this moment where Bill Murray kept trying and trying and trying, and he figured out how to rob a bank.
Yeah.
So at some point, I might indulge a little bit. I don't know that I would try and rob a bank, but something that was almost seemed impossible, I'd keep trying to do it until I got it right. I don't know that I would play board games endlessly. I would try and spend some time with some of my family members.
Yeah, that's cool. I think after doing all my worst instincts, I would drive really awesome cars really fast without any worry that I was going to crash and die, because I would just respawn, right?
Point of clarification, is that not on the list of bad instincts?
No. Well, yes.
So I will say this.
I'm just a horrible person.
Not to put myself on the point of clarification list.
Okay.
However.
Yeah.
I will say this. I like my job, But if it's going to be a Groundhog Day situation, there'd be three or four of those revolutions where I'd walk in and just like kick over stuff and like just pick up somebody else's like computer and smash it and be like, what? What are you going to do? You going to fire me? Why quit? Like, I would just kind of wild out for like two or three kind of days and just kind of explore that a little bit.
I wouldn't even go to work.
Yeah, I think I would have to get on the learning languages and instruments train, a little like in Groundhog when he actually learns to play the piano. I think I would do that for a while. I also worry, so in the actual movie Groundhog Day, he goes through a period where he just kills himself every day because it gets really dark. Mm-hmm. I actually worry that if I were the only creature who knew it was happening, that I would take it to a dark place unless I worked really hard on it. And I might, unfortunately, go through some of those cycles.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I kind of wonder if I would just keep doing a lot of the things I do. I would play board games. I'd eat tacos. I'd take care of my chickens and go hiking with my boyfriend.
I would like, not go to work.
I don't know if I would do anything grander.
I would not clean my house.
Because you're going to wake, just clean it at the end. I mean, it's going to be clean when you wake up in the morning.
I'm saying.
I would definitely,
or not. Like,
or where, not.
Whatever
that's
the
a good
state
point.
It is going to be in. Yeah, all the things that I feel like I have to do or I should do, none of that would get done. And it would be all about what I want. Like, I would have, I think probably for like 16 revolutions in a row, I'd probably wake up and eat chocolate cake.
Yeah.
Like, that would be breakfast.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I also think that I would probably at least every now and then tell people that, yeah, we've been here before. And, like, just freak them out. Yeah. I would definitely do that.
If there was someone who would believe you, then that would be fun to sit and have those conversations.
Yeah. What does this all mean? Yeah. What does it mean for you? You're going to forget tomorrow. Yeah. I'm going to edit what I said before. I would spend every waking moment with my wife.
Aw, see, that's better.
Watching that Star Trek.
With your adorable bunny, Sunday.
With my little bunny, Sunday. Yeah.
I think that his name is Sunday is what really does it for me. Yeah. That is goddamn adorable.
Oh, thank you.
I think I would try and see if I could come up with like the perfect date for my wife. Like, see if I could get it right. Like, the right place. Like, just
the right episode of Star Trek to show her.
Right. or the right episode of Doctor Who. Like, you know, that's another thing I would probably do. Is over the course of the Groundhog Day span, you could go back and watch every episode of Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could.
That's true.
You could destroy a series really quickly and binge over and over and over.
You kind of need a Groundhog Day scenario to watch all of
that's
Doctor
the only
Who.
Way it's going to happen.
That's the only way it's going to happen.
Like, if you're someone out there listening and you're thinking, man, I have heard about Doctor Who, and I've always wanted to jump in. Hey, you just need to pick a season and jump in. Like, you can't try and start from the beginning. You'll never make it.
Never.
I think I would take a profound interest in pressing my ability to go to faraway places, given wherever my spawn point is. So I have all the time in the world. I'm in this loop, but I'm limited, right? Like, I can't go anywhere. Like, I can't, you know.
You reset back in your house.
Yeah, right? Reset back in my house. So yeah. I can't fly to Australia. I can't do the crazy shit that's like, oh, well, if I have infinite time and there's no consequence, I can spend as much money tomorrow as I want and lobby back again. But there's still some serious limitations, I guess.
Yeah, one flight would get to me.
Yeah, that would get to
That'd
me
be
too.
So your life becomes so restricted.
Yeah.
If it's 24 hours, then yeah. If it's a 24-hour flight, then just as you're getting there,
click,
wake up.
Yeah.
What the hell, Huffnagel?
You made me sad. No, I'm just kidding. That was another great question from our bestie.
Yeah. And guys, again, submit your questions on Facebook, on Twitter. Just go to StarTrekPod.com, click on those social media links, click on that Patreon link. We can't do this without you. So please support us at whatever level you're able to. We'll love you for it. And we love you for listening.
And for correcting our mistakes.
Yes.
Thank you for that as well.
And for doing it so kindly. We appreciate that. All right. I think we're good. Come back next week. We'll be talking about the fall finale of Star Trek Discovery. I guess we'll break for a little while after that, and then we'll come back and talk about the next episode. Ashley, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter @Squiddy, and I'm on Instagram @Squiddy.
What's going to be on your Instagram soon?
Well, among pictures of my chickens and food I'm baking, I recently had an away mission to an M-class planet, Renfest. So I borrowed a friend, he shall remain nameless, his name is Mike Moody's, Spock costume, which I took, and for the most part, I think people found it charming. I even got to spout the importance of recycling in the future.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right. Doing God's work.
Exactly.
Clyde, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Twitter at Clyde Haynes, and you can find me at www.keyandclyde.com. That's KEI and Clyde.com.
You can find me at Mike Moody on Twitter. Don't forget to visit our podcast network, Permanent Record, at permanentrcrd.com to listen to tons of TV podcasts. And we'll be back next week. Live long and prosper.